Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, I get to co-host with my good friend, Weston Woodward. Weston, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
So, Weston, you have such an interesting background, but I'm going to let you describe what you do and why you know all these celebrities and fancy people and investors and nonprofit stuff, and then introduce our great guest for this episode.
Perfect. Well, yeah. So I'm Weston, based here in Austin, Texas. I call myself a connector. And what that really means is I just know a lot of people and I like connecting the dots. I'm curious by nature. I love to hear what people are passionate about, what their interests are, what their needs are, and then see who they need to meet in my universe. And one of the people that I love connecting for is my dear friend, Stephen Sabo, who's joining us today. Stephen has a really impressive background in the finance world. He's now one of the founders and partners of Hamptons Tech Week and is always involved in some cool projects that I love chatting to him about. And I'm happy to be an advisor to Hamptons Tech Week as well.
We're lucky to have you, Weston. Thanks for having me on.
So, Weston, why don't you kick us off with our first couple of questions?
So, Stephen, what is the most exciting thing you're seeing right now in your universe within sports, emerging tech, everything like that? What would you say is like the most exciting thing?
It's funny. There's a number of them, but I would say the interest level across the board, really everybody has turned on to sports as an alternative asset class that was really just for the super wealthy before that and really just to distribute wealth across of different streams and not have it related to the other assets that they owned. Now, I think it's really converging into an asset class that a lot of people are going to own. And even if they don't know they own it, they're going to have pieces of it through funds that are now mandating percentages to go into sports. Sports and media are now blurring the line. So a lot of these things now are going to just open up the market into the sports industry. You know, it might be on the franchise side. It might be on a sports tech deal. It might just be on the rights, as we discussed. But yeah, the interest in the industry itself has really expanded. And you see a lot of companies that are now major companies getting into this. I mean, Goldman Sachs, for example, is now doing a sports bank, and a lot of people are talking about it more actively. You know, these are things that are not going to be a blip on the radar for a year or two. This is a 25-year play for them. So I would say that's the most exciting.
And then where do you think most of this interest is coming from? Like what's been the shift and people getting super excited about sports and sports investments?
Fandom, right? Where the attention's coming from. I think that is the most exciting part of it. And people know as things are shifting and attention is harder to get than ever, you know, sports will always draw the attention. Sports will always have an amount of loyalty that you really can't explain, right? Products don't have loyalty like sports does. You know, there's going to be another realm of media. I mean, Wrexham, for an example, I mean, they've done such a good job with that series and people really caring and connecting to a story that there's so many other stories that could be told through a team or through sports in that area. You see it because they've already transacted on another team, which is now in Mexico. You know, that's very likely to have a media play behind it, obviously.
Yeah.
And we're going to see a lot more of those integrations into, you know, blurring the lines of products, media, communities, and sports at the helm.
And where would you say is the greatest opportunity, like for folks, especially those that are listening that are maybe wanting to break into investing in a sports or sports tech? Like what areas, what regions would be the easiest way for them to get plugged in?
I would say it depends on the investor, obviously, in that sense. If you're an institutional investor and you're looking for exposure more on the franchise side, my opinion is Europe is where you should look. You know, soccer teams in Europe, there's a lot of opportunity there. And there's really the risk that the U.S. sports don't run. And because it's relegation, you know, there's a huge risk in buying a team in Europe and having the potential of them going down a division, right? There's a lot of money lost in that play, but there's also money gained on that play because they can go up and make a lot more money on the TV rights and other things like tournaments that you take a much bigger risk, but it's more interesting, right? So it's, you know, the U.S. side of it, that's not as much there, but it's also priced in because they know the risk isn't as prevalent.
Yeah, which I think is very interesting because especially coming from someone that grew up watching just American sports, to know that the risk level, and I think Ted Lasso is really pretty instrumental in educating the audience in America that there's risk in every game you play in football over there or soccer. Do you want to kind of like explain like what that means, relegation? Because I know I've started hearing some whispers that maybe some U.S. sports might start looking to do that.
Yeah.
But maybe like go through like what does relegation even mean?
God, I would be so happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. High level, right? Take it from the Premier League, right? Or the championship level. They play into divisions of the sport. So the Premier League is the top of English football and the championship is right below them, right? So the top of the championship is promoted to the Premier League. You know, it'll be a number of teams and there's a playoff system that they can play into, you know, as they win through the playoff system, they get promoted and there's some automatic promotion spots. But then the bottom three teams in the Premier League each year are relegated. So they drop into the championship division. So that inherently three of the 20 teams are going to be in danger in the Premier League every single year. So that creates its own, you know, stress from an investment standpoint that creates opportunity for all the championship teams to create a great environment to go up and then make all the money that the Premier League teams make. But within the States, there's, you know, a good example is who's going to watch. I'm a Broncos fan, so this actually was relevant from last year. Once we were out of the race, you know, and we knew Russ was gone and we knew that, you know, the last couple of games didn't matter. Who's watching us play the Patriots, right? When it doesn't matter for either team, you know, in soccer abroad, every game matters. That last game of the year, the relegation battle is just as good as the top. Sometimes better because sometimes the winner of the league is determined already and the spots are all sewn up. Champions League, Europa, and all that. But the relegation battle is never really decided until the end because those points are huge. So that, you know, you're watching the media rights be so much more valuable because now every game is really able to be televised because it matters and it's worth something to these players and the teams. You know, it's the next contract is not guaranteed in any sense.
That's fascinating. Well, Jess, I would love to hear kind of your thoughts on sports. Like, what are you thinking about what Steven's saying about Europe and U.S. and sports investing? Or what have you heard in your universe?
Yeah, I think that, like, obviously owning a sports team was always prestigious in the States. And, you know, but in some ways, like, it felt a little bit like owning fancy restaurants, or it was for a lot of folks, it was more about it was maybe not taken as business serious by all the owners, right? Where it does seem now that people are bringing like a little more investment rigor to it. You know, on our offline here before we started, I talked about, you know, Billy and I have been in a number of conversations with about looking at both, you know, NBA team here and Premier League team and, you know, do some, I work a little bit with a Middle East sovereign wealth fund who, you know, she had another call last week where they're explaining, well, we own part of this team here and this team there, but we're really looking for sports rights, but we'll also do the consumer side if they have the rights. And it is like, it's moving from like, you know, I feel like the ratio of like glamour to true investment, like the ratio is getting closer. Like the glamour is still there, but the ticker seems to be closer to people bringing like true investment. And then again, look at, you know, I got invited down to the McLaren event at Formula One in the fall and was meeting with the guy who runs it was on the show, Guy Horner. So his brother is the team principal at for Red Bull, and his business partner won Formula One like 13 times against like Michael Schumacher and like the Ferrari heydays, right? And he was just, you know, we were talking about like how Netflix drive to survive really changed Formula One in America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's funny you guys brought him up before I could, but like, I feel like between Ryan Reynolds and Ted Lasso, like the UK football, you know, we call soccer world, got put on a lot more Americans' plates and Canadians and, right? And so there's this natural thing of like, people aspire to what they see a lot. They, you know, there's a reason that the Bible calls us sheep, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know if you guys see this in venture investing and other things. It's like, you know, no venture capitalists have anything to do with fashion. Then all of a sudden somebody's in fashion and they make some money. And now every VC firm is doing Allbirds and you know, like all of a sudden, now all of a sudden, like fashion is a venture capital investment, right? Yeah. Like I think the sheep factor is pretty undeniable about humans, and you know, supposedly objective investors are still humans, right? And so it gets a lot of attention. You know, again, Ryan Reynolds, Ted Lasso, Drive to Survive. You know, we had Amit Sakharan on, who does Religion of Sports. So he and Tom Brady and Deepak Chopra's son make these like really, really incredible sports documentaries. And whether they go to Netflix or other places, they're just like, they're not mailing it in. Like, they're just on another level type of docs that are so engaging. And look at how much, you know, docs were like a classic place to lose money historically.
Yeah.
And then you look at those last years when Netflix figured out, hold on, we can spend so much less to buy a doc and get, but not get the, like the arbitrage of pay this much for narrative or this much for a doc. Well, you get less viewers for the doc, but it's not proportional. Like, the doc was actually a better buy a lot of times. So all of a sudden there's a bunch of good money, you know, like more money than was historically available if you could create something that would really grab the attention. You know, I'm sure there's other factors, but those are some of the things to me. So Steve, will you tell us about where Hamptons Tech Week is, what it is, how somebody can get in, all the good things?
Yeah, of course. So we moved it to June 4th to the 6th, or a little bit later in the season last year, pushed it up a little bit in the season, better for traffic, better for booking. So we also moved venues this year. We went from Southampton, we're going to be in East Hampton, and we're at the Longhouse Reserve, which is an absolutely beautiful venue. Fingers crossed for no rain. We're going to be on an outdoor stage in front of one of their most beautiful art sculptures. Obviously, we do have a stage in another area if needed for the rain, but we're banking that it won't. So incredible group of people. Really started it because I'm similar to Weston. I'm nowhere near as good as Weston at this, but I like connecting the dots and putting good people in the same rooms. So that was the start of this. And we were also going to large format conferences just over COVID. And a lot of the value that I was seeing is just the inner circles anyway. I wasn't getting a lot of value from the actual conference. I was just meeting friends of friends and making connections from there. So wanted to design a conference around that idea. So the branding is now a micro conference for the Hamptons, which just means no more than 350 people. Over the 3 days in the Hamptons. And we really wanted to be a macro perspective. So industry leaders talking about the trends in technology instead of more of a developers conference and getting in the weeds. I want it to be, you know, insightful for everybody. You could just walk into any panel and understand what's being discussed and have something tangible from those conversations. But a lot of the value is who you're going to meet in the room and, you know, a lot of the connecting that goes on at the happy hour after at the VIP party, which is on June 4th to open up the festivities this year.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah, one of the things that I love about Hamptons Tech Week 2 is it's almost like it's less of like a stuffy conference and more, I think, because most of the attendees are just friends or friends of friends of the folks that are putting it on. So it's, you don't feel like, oh, who am I going to meet? Like, you're going to have warm intros nonstop when you're at this event.
And what are the topics that are going to be covered this year?
This year, I've broken it down into blocks of conversations. It was funny. We had conversations just free flowing the prior year. It would be a tech CEO and then an art panel right after, which had its own interest. I actually loved that, how that flowed too. And it put a lot of interesting people in the room next to each other. But this year, I broke it down into blocks of conversations that are, each conversation is 30 minutes long. And there's five conversations per block. And the four blocks are going to be sports, which is the morning of day one of the panels, which is June 5th. The afternoon session is going to be on media. And then the morning of day two, emerging technologies. Afternoon will be culture and entertainment. So, you know, broad stroke on all of those things. We'll touch on a lot of topics that are adjacent to those topics. But those are the main focus areas for this year.
And can you talk about your background with Web3 and some of the different things that you've been up to?
Sure. Yeah. So background was really always within finance, personal financial planning, high-end life insurance for estate planning purposes was my background for, you know, 12, 13 years. During COVID, made a shift into more of the institutional side of the business. So started a partner at a broker dealer now, work at a number of sports deals. You know, we can work on the franchise deals like we discussed earlier, but also running a Series A for a sports tech company currently. But yeah, I would say those are the main focuses for my background. And then really the start of this conference too is to be more business development and putting a bunch of good people in the room. But I did used to have an event series called Vin and Fin, which was my only event background before this. And that was putting a CFP and a sommelier in the same room to teach about wine and finance together over four flights. So obviously, you know, financial seminars are pretty dry and boring. So we wanted to spice it up and make sure the content was palatable, which was always my joke for the wine side of things. So did a bunch of those in 2019 and then actually brought them back recently instead of for the personal financial planning side, networking purposes for VC, family office, private equity, to kind of share deal flow, but also just network and talk about the trends in more of a fun setting.
Very fun. I'm interested, you know, Weston and I met at our, so, you know, we got the Innovation Leadership podcast here. And then my brother and I, Nick, who co-own the media company, we partnered with this great woman, Laura Walker Lee. She's a CEO for a film finance fund for a billionaire family. We partnered with her. We do a series called Innovation Leadership Live. And they're just these like, sometimes they're smaller get-togethers. Usually they're like a sit-down dinner for 50. It's just like this eclectic mix of people off my podcast and her Hollywood friends and just like,
yeah.
We'll have like a fireside chat to kick it off. But then it's just like 4 or 5 hours of no agenda. We just say like, hey, we're not selling anything. We're not raising money for my child rescue charity. Like this is just for you. I hope you meet somebody who can help you with your business. But we've given everybody, everybody who's confirmed, they get this booklet that's got everybody else's photo and bio. So they know who everyone else is in the room. So we like, we're really intentional about who sits at each table, but then they can also just, after dinner's over, they just get up and go meet the person that they read about that they wanted to meet, right? And they're all shocked at the end when they get through the whole night and we didn't try to sell them anything, right?
right, exactly, yeah.
We have like, I can't believe the response. I mean, like we're always like having to apologize because there's so many people trying to get in. We're like, I'm sorry, we're trying to keep this intimate. And so I have continually thought about like doing more of a mini conference. And I would love to hear your thoughts on like, why are these more like intimate events where you can actually have like real conversations instead of just sit through like sage on a stage? Why do you think they're like, I don't know, having a moment right now?
I do think COVID played a part in this significantly because one, people were kept inside for so long and that I think they really appreciated, hey, we can now do this and we're not taking it for granted anymore to be able to go out and network it face to face. But the micro conference or the small gathering nature, I think, especially in settings that we've set up, we're pretty focused on the curation of it. And the fact that people can enter this space with the assumption that there's good people in the room and it's not a 1 in 10 people that you meet and share a card with at a main conference are good people. It's much more in the 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 range that these are going to be good conversations. That their walls come down, right? So they're just going to be so much more likely to engage in a real conversation and be, you know, fully engaged in the whole event because of that, because the numbers are just going to be through the roof and it's not a lottery, right? It's every person in the room is going to be good. So people have to be on their game so much more because they know the other person is in the same situation.
You know, I think my favorite word in your sentence there was curated, right? I think that is such a key. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been super excited about your guys' event. Like, I thought it sounded so cool ever since Weston started telling me about it. And I guess it is that, like, it doesn't hurt to have it as kind of a cool location, right? Like, feels fancy.
An incredible partner for this year, yeah.
It is that curated factor because we've all been to enough conferences where it's like, oh my gosh, it's like needles in a haystack of, like, who I was actually trying to meet. And, like, let's face it, so many of the people you really want to meet just don't go to the conferences where everybody else is, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Weston, you throw a lot of cool events and you're always getting sponsors and you're like, you're really in this world of curating. What's your thought on how to curate an event that is like unmissable where people all show up?
Well, I think the key is definitely the people. You know, we talked about curation. I think if you get the right people coming to your event, the event's going to be awesome. I just put on an event a few weeks ago with the new diplomat from Singapore here in Austin. And we didn't do like pull out a lot of bells and whistles for the event. It was just, we wanted to get good people in the room, and we had about 65 yeah. people with little promotion, but they knew it was all about who's going to be in that room. So I think if people know that there's going to be good quality people, and they're not going to have to worry about, like, Jess, I think what you do at your dinners is perfect. Like, not being pitched, because most people are getting pitched all the time, especially if you're dealing with like investors or family offices. So if they can come to a spot where they're going to meet interesting people, they're not getting pitched, and it's also been somewhat vetted so that they don't have to worry about like who they're chatting with. I think that's where the magic is. I think if you want to add like some, you know, some bells and whistles to attract folks, like having some piece of art and culture or something that's a little bit more unique that you want to experience at an event, I think adds to it. But at the root of it, at the center of it, is definitely the people. And cool settings also help too. So I think if you can find a cool location like the Longhouse Reserve, like where Hamptons Tech Week is going to be in the Hamptons. You know, I know a lot of people that I've invited that have not been the Hamptons. You know, it's a place that they always have heard about and they want to go experience. And so it gives them a good reason to for this event. But definitely the core of it is people, because I personally believe, especially in America, we're having a loneliness epidemic. I remember reading in a report in 2019 from Cigna that 50% of American adults don't have a friend. And so I think people are yearning for community and to find like their tribe or their people. And so events like Hamptons Tech Week or some of the events that I do or you do, Jess, I think that's what people are craving. They want that human connection to find like-minded individuals. And it's needed more than ever.
Sorry, I just wanted to mention one thing. Sorry, I wanted us to all sync up there too, because we were speaking at different levels. But I wanted to touch on one thing before we moved on. And that was one thing that you both mentioned, and I know that I do at my events. And it's the intentionality and going above and beyond of having the profile of the people, you know, presented at the dinners. And I know Weston does this way better than me, but I also try to do this. But I take each person that I know, usually I know everybody's job or purpose of being there intimately from a business standpoint, and I walk them and introduce them to somebody who would be good for them to meet, right? And that's something that doesn't happen at bigger conferences. One's because nobody can keep all of that stuff in their mind, and Weston does this at an incredible rate, and he connects people offline. It doesn't have to be in the conference. Even if you're coming, he'll do this offline constantly, and he's a master connector. But for the founders or people on the leadership team to go above and beyond to make those connections for you and walk you into somebody that is going to be good, that is something that you really value. And that's an invaluable piece of an event, because I think it has gotten harder for people to just pop into an event, right? It's people's time seems more valuable these days because they're not just sitting in an office and it's a happy hour downstairs and you just go to somewhere in New York City. Like, even to meet somebody in my office for my broker dealer, we have to plan it out. We're not just in the same office at the same time anymore, which is funny, but it's so much more intentional nowadays to schedule things out. And I really do think that people react and appreciate that the three of us do that and events that do that.
I have to double down. Weston invited me to his South by Southwest party he was doing with AJ and those friends, right? Mm-hmm. And he did that for me like 20 times that day, and just walking on, oh, Jess, you got to come meet this person. And they were like such solid people. You know, this guy works at the NFL. These guys are making this movie. Like, it just is like person after person. Yep. He did that for me. So I agree. Okay, back to you, Weston.
I'm telling you, man, he's the best at it. He won't take credit.
Okay. Steve, so why don't you tell the listeners, like, who are the types of people that show up to Hamptons Tech Week? And then who would you say are some of the speakers that you're most interested to hear from? Like, what are their backgrounds?
So attendees, I'll go. Usually I try to explain it in thirds. So I always want to kind of create an interesting and a productive environment for everybody. So in this stand, it's, you know, investors are always key to business, right? You got to fuel the tank. So investors, typically VC, family office, private equity, are essential to have in the room. And then the other essential factor for the investors is to have opportunity in the room. So usually it's somebody at some stage of a raise, or they will be raising soon at some point. So that always creates pretty dynamic and interesting group. And then the other third is really the advisors of those companies. and the thought leaders in each industry, because I want you to feel like you're hearing stuff before the rest of the public, or you're behind that closed door. A lot of the industry leaders are sharing. We're not broadcasting this. We're not putting this on YouTube or online yet, maybe in future series, but this is meant to be more of a meeting of friends and sharing of ideas, but really telling you where the industries are going. And our tagline, and I'm giving credit to our COO, Simon Bailey, came up with this, but it's where the future meets. And I really do think that, because all of the industry leaders and thought leaders are here and telling us what they think, and they see the future. They're the ones driving the future. So that's the makeup of the conference and the attendees. And I'm definitely not going to get caught in the trap of telling you my favorite speakers. Not that I have any other favorite speakers. But there's so many dynamic conversations that are going to be taking place, that people who've done it for 40 years in an industry and people who are really the next and upcoming talent in their industry. I love hearing about sports. Obviously, the Series A race that I'm doing for AI.io and their groundbreaking technology in soccer specifically. I just so happen to love soccer. And there's a lot of things that are both personally relevant that I just want to hear about from my own stance, from understanding what's going on in soccer and how my favorite team is going to scout the next player. But then also on the industry side of investing, right? I want to know, I'm not in media every day. That's not my world, but I really want to hear from the experts about where media is going, because it's relevant for investing in a bunch of different ways. And the crossover of those people, I just think is super dynamic, because sports and media, I put them on the same day because I really think those two things are completely meshing, right? And it's those lines are so blurred now. And I really do think that will continue to be a trend in the future. And this will be the perfect example of, oh, when did that switch from sports to media and back and forth? Because they're so integrated now.
I agree. Well, for Hamptons Tech Week and the future of Hamptons Tech Week, what are you most excited about? I know you guys are starting to do like 2-day summits. Do you want to kind of tell the audience, tell Jess, like kind of what you have in store for the future?
Absolutely. And this is the first time that I've been intentional, because I've been told to be intentional by a very good friend of mine who's Dennis Prescott. And he's actually curating the menu for the VIP party. So that was our first step into elevating the experiences from more than just the speaking standpoint. And we have a lot of great partners for that too. So that was a very fun part. And he's going to be intricately involved in the future of the conference as well, which I think is important, because people need to be comfortable in these settings. And the relationships are going to be made over time, right? This is just a good place to meet, but it just helps in the future. And then we've really expanded into one areas that I like that have local flavor. So they're going to be specific around, what businesses in the area are good at. And of course, we'll bring in some of our own flavor from the Hamptons. But we did a conference down in Lake Nona in January, and that was incredible. You know, Lake Nona is known for their sports and their tech investing and healthcare. They're very, very strong in healthcare. We're also going to be going to Napa and London in the fall. So Napa will be in September, London will be in mid-October, and both of those are going to have local flavor. Very excited about both of them and the way that we can really highlight what's going on locally, but then also always having that global macro perspective for the conference. And then who knows where 25 is bringing us. I think, you know, we will have our flagship, of course, in the Hamptons. London seems to be like a growing flagship. And then we'll see what the other locations are going to end up being.
Jess, you have any other questions?
Yeah, I got lots of questions, but we only have like so long for the show. So I want to talk about something that, you know, this show has tons of founders and CEOs and investment managers that listen to it. And something that is of never-ending fascination is raising money, whether you got to get LPs for your fund or whether you need VCs for your company or any variation on this kind of thing, right? When you think about these transactions, you see millions and millions of dollars. What are some rookie mistakes you see when people are out trying to raise large amounts?
Thinking it's easy. Jumping into the institutional side, of course I can do this. It is not easy. It is so hard. And now the trends too have been, since it was so difficult to raise capital in the last couple of years for everybody, even if you were a great company. I think the moving of the goalposts has kind of set everybody back a little bit more, right? Like, did VCs ever ask about revenue until recently? Like, I don't know, I'm newer to this, but I've heard that this has not been a trend. And there's just a lot of that that you, one, need to be really focused on your story, but you need to be more balanced and have a path into the future and have that market share pretty much guaranteed now. A lot of people want to see more guarantees, not guarantees from a revenue standpoint, but the likelihood. I think people are waiting a little bit longer than they would in the past to invest in companies. You know, there's a lot of checks and balances that are going into it that before, you know, I feel it's not the Wild West right now in VC at all. They're being very thoughtful and being a little bit more active than they have been in the past.
Yeah, I listen to a lot of podcasts from top VCs, but also from shows where they're interviewing LPs, whether that's large families or institutions that are taking the positions in these VC funds. And something they say is like that a lot of times these vintages are actually the best. You know, 2009, 2010, like yeah. The people who have the guts to try something when everything is not easy, it's like a lot of times tends towards like higher conviction people who are willing to like put up with more crap and pivot and persevere. Mm-hmm. And when the money isn't free anymore and you can just show up with an idea and say you have, this is a $3 million valuation just because you had an idea, right? Like when the money's not free, it takes a higher conviction entrepreneur or mm-hmm. first-time fund manager to go out in these times. And so they talk about how, yes, it's harder, but your probability of actually backing the right horse goes up. And so it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition, right?
Yeah, I think, so I actually want to highlight, I've been running Vin and Fins with a friend of mine, a family that I've been friends with for a little while now. But Trace Cohen has said in our Vin and Fins and also just on LinkedIn in a number of ways that VC, the lines are being blurred now, because VC used to mean you're going for a 50X, 100X, right? And I think that is changing now. The true VCs and the way that they invest is still very much to hit that 100X, 50X player. And I think a lot of people now are happy with a 5X over a number of years, right? Yeah. There's ways to invest now, but again, that's blurred lines, right? It's now just spreading this generalist way to invest now. It's just the spectrum, and it's just understanding how, you know, who you're investing in and what their goals actually are, because matching those goals is just as important as what they invest in. If they're going for 100X and your goal is for 5 or 10X, that's probably not the fund for you or the person you should be investing with. But yeah, I've learned so much from this family. I mean, Maxwell, Brian, Trace, and Carol have been all intricately involved with Hampton's Tech Week, but really just learning from them too and being in a world that it was new to me a number of years ago. Yeah. You know, and they obviously have made their waves in the VC community and been thought leaders in that community specifically. But it is ever changing, and it's you need to be very transparent with, one, your investors and two, your thesis about what you're investing in and what the purpose is.
Yeah, it's almost like a third asset class has emerged between venture capital and private equity. This like growth capital investor.
Yep.
Kind of like VC, kind of like PE, but it is its own animal in the middle, right? And for people not familiar with those folks you just brought up, can you give them some backgrounds?
Sure. At the family in itself, they've just really come into Hampton's Tech Week and been so supportive. We're having the VIP party at their house. So, you know, they're all doing panels and being involved. But the background, I mean, they run New York Venture Partners, and they have been active in this space for 25 years, I think, at this point. And Trace and Max really work with startups now. So seed range, you know, even pre-seed levels, and being active in helping those founders. And Trace is really just a great voice. I mean, he's hilarious. He posts memes and kind of videos constantly about the VC world, but really, really insightful as well. And he's the one who runs the majority of the Vin and Fin, and I'll pop in every now and then, but he's the one really educating the community. And I would say it's been passed along from his parents I mean, they were all forced, from what I've heard, to start a business before they were, I don't know, 25 or 27, something like that. But I, in my opinion, that's better than an MBA for sure now, because you learn so much about people, about life, about business when you have to do it yourself as a founder, right? You have to wear so many hats. And it's really just an invaluable experience.
So I'm interested where you cover both the, like, you know, the buttoned up institutional finance world, and then you also have like artists at your events. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm making this observation that there is like, there's also like a new style of investor out there where, like, instead of having to like go to the boardroom and do your presentation with a whole line of people in suits, all these analysts, and, you know, there's this like very formal aspect, and do you have 40 Excel spreadsheets all modeled correctly, to like,
yeah,
sitting with a super wealthy founder who might have as much money as a whole institution, who's like, you know, there in his khakis and skate shoes, and just like, he just wants the brass tacks. He doesn't need all that MBA crap, you know?
Exactly.
And like, you look at how many athletes are involved, and like, yes, they have advisors and stuff, but like, you know, I'm thinking about like the kind of people that go to Weston's party. I'm sure there's a lot of overlap with people who go to your parties, and, yep, and maybe some overlap with the people who come to my parties.
Yep.
And there's like a ton of money in the room, and it is not the old school, like, give the, you know, investment banking style DAC and do the da-da-da and the whole thing. It, the process is different. So I'm interested how you see that evolving, because there obviously is such a huge institutional world still there, but they used to just look down their nose on anybody who, like, all my New York investment banking buddies just like look down their nose on things like crowdfunding and non-institutional deals, like you little people, the peasants, right? And now there's funding sources as big as them who are not formal. And it does seem like there's an evolution there. I'm interested in your thoughts of this kind of super buttoned up world to super not buttoned up world interacting.
I mean, just from a personal standpoint, I, in the city office every single day, suited and booted, like tied, like I wore bow ties at one point. Like there was endless, like I never went anywhere without a suit. Like if the tie came off, like that's it, happy hour or later. Now, if I'm in a suit, people are like, is everything okay? Like, did somebody pass away? Like, what's going on? And, or like, this is the biggest meeting of my life if I throw a suit on, which, like, even now I would do in a t-shirt, crew, whatever it is. I think that entire shift has come. COVID, of course, it blew that through the water. Like, you can show up in now fashionable wear, and that's very normal for meetings. And I think it's even weird for people to now wear a suit. Like if I would go to somebody's house in the personal financial world and we were just doing a presentation, like you were kind of expected 10 years ago to be in a suit. And now if I sort of showed up in a suit, that'd be weird. Like just in my opinion. And then most people in the Northeast, at least, like that is not, you know, nobody's wearing ties. And if you're wearing a tie, like we pretty much know the three places that you work, you know? So it's just that world has completely changed and it's got normal. But it goes back to people want to work with humans, and humans are running everything, and people just want that interaction and they want personality to kind of shine through. And I think attire is a way to do that, you know, and that's, God, I could go on an entire tangent here in the sports space. I'm at my last event in Lake Nona, we had Erica Malbin speak alongside Ray Matei, and I don't know if you follow golf, but they've had a whole thing with their attire kind of changing. And this is very similar of the conversation of old golf world, the way that you're expected to dress and the things that are allowed, and new golf culture, streetwear culture coming in through golf. And Jason Day wore a vest that he was told to take off, and it was this whole PR thing at the Masters. And of course, you're at the Masters, no problem, take it off right away. You know, very respectful, the focus is on the tournament. But it is a conversation that this underlying tone across the board, old school, new school, the way that things are going to be done, how it is changing. I don't think we're going back to the other way, or at least it's going to be a mix, you know, and it's not one way goes anymore.
It's interesting how, you know, how we cut our hair, how we groom ourselves, how we dress is such a signal to the rest of the world about our opinion of ourselves, which is then an opinion, which is then like a lead indicator of how they should think of us, right? And like, you know, look at beards. I'm envious. I will never grow a beard as good as Weston's, right? Weston has got a superior level beard. Here.
Oh, I'll never grow hair like you have.
So,
next level.
You think about like beards, for instance, right? Like, it's a whole thing. And you're like, you got the hipster beard, or you got like the special ops guy beard, or you've got you know, you got the like Jason Statham stubble. Like, you know what I mean? Like, what kind of beard are we talking here, right? Yeah. And it's like, it does signal to things to different people, right? Where you're at, and like the kind of beard you have signals how you view the world. Like, doing like, is it long and straight cut and sticks out, or is it just like a Jason Statham stubble thing? And it is like, it's interesting how much we are looking for cues to be more efficient, right? Like, mm-hmm. I remember, so again, coming out of Citigroup, I'm a suit every day kind of guy, right?
Yep.
And I remember I remember years back when a friend of mine said, two tech guys were joking, really successful tech companies here in Utah. And they're like, oh yeah, you can always tell a guy's never worked in VC when he shows up to a job interview in a suit, and they just start laughing. And I was like, I would have done that. I for sure would have worn a suit to a job interview at a multi-billion dollar company of any sort, right? And it was just like, oh, wow, you know? And it's like, it's like the words we use or the acronyms we use. Like, if you want to learn any industry, or at least you want to be, give the feeling, get invited more into the Insider Club, learn the acronyms. Do you know what I mean? Like CMO, is that Chief Marketing Officer or Chief Medical Officer? You know, CIO, is that a Chief Investment Officer? Is that a Chief Information Officer? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, who you're talking to and how you use the acronyms. I mean, in the Department of Defense, you know, I used to do all this leadership training for special ops guys. I mean, I feel like they can get through entire sentences in only acronyms.
You know? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But you're close to the same thing. I was at this breakfast with a bunch of CEOs here just south of Park City yesterday morning. And like, one of the guys, probably the highest net worth guy in the room, he's got like kind of like, you know, Lululemon / REI kind of pants, right? He's this venture capitalist. And he's got kind of the skate shoe style shoe, but they're a Zegna skate shoe. You know what I mean? And there's like, there's all these things about like, when you go out there, it's like, okay, at the tech company, like these guys wear hoodies, but these people wear nicer shoes and maybe a button up or a sweater. But then the VC guys, I think the VC guys are the worst. With the plaid shirts and the Patagonia vest, like that's just, or like the suit coat and jeans, like, oh, really?
The Midtown uniform.
So being that I'm in VC, I'm like, so what do I wear? So anyways, I'm open for fashion advice. Now that this is like, all my longevity venture deals were going through these days.
Heck, God, billion-dollar biotech is definitely not in my fashion realm of education, or I can't suggest anything to you, but God, whatever you're comfortable in, it's funny. That's what's going to come across. It's, if you're comfortable in what you're wearing, usually that's a good sign that you're going to be in your best performance just personally. And usually people take offense to that, unless it's like very off, then that's probably a signal, right, of who you should be working with. And I just had a conversation with a friend that we were just kind of going through things, and it, you know, at some points in your career, you really just pick to do business with friends. And he said to me, I only want to do business with friends from now on. And he was like, it's really nice to be able to say that, but also it doesn't feel like work ever, because I'm constantly talking to people that I want to talk to.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes back into like, I don't give a shit what you wear, Weston, or like whatever you show up in. Like, I've been with you. I've never been with you in a suit, I don't think, but like it never matters, right? And it's just one of those things, like, we've touched almost every industry in some way, or connected each other in some way to every industry, and it, like, has never mattered, like, especially now.
It only matters.
I think that's a good thing, though.
It only matters from getting the meeting with them to the friendship point, right? And then after the friendship point, like, when you really know who people are on the inside, all the rest is superfluous. But it's like,
I agree.
Man, people are starved for time. And like, if you approach somebody at a conference, like, you're like, oh, I know that guy's the CEO of a billion-dollar company, so I'll catch him in the hall and ask him to be on the podcast, right? He has very few data points to make that decision. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, I've got like maybe three sentences. I've got maybe like three sentences before he's like looking for the exit. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you got to do like, you got to express the right things. You got even the right signals in those three sentences. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to not look like, you know, you're homeless or something. You know what I mean? Right? Like, you gotta, like, he's, right. he's, He's got a very short amount of time, and you need to like give him the most, because I mean the default answer is no. Like it's just no unless you can somehow get over some certain bar with enough signals, right?
Yeah.
It's the like, oh, why don't you send an email to my assistant? Let's look at a time. And you know, it's either like you have to get above a really high bar to not get the brush off, right? And so anyways, it is an interesting thing. But I will say one of the other things that I admire about both of you is one of the top things I think that gives people a signal is who are your friends? Like who trusts you? We have all met that big talker, and I just produced this movie with so-and-so and I da-da-da-da-da, right? And you're like, wow, this guy sounds like he should run for president, like better than the two we've got running right now, right? And then and then it's like, as soon as you start talking to anybody else, they're like, well, I'm not saying he didn't have anything to do with that movie, but that might be a real stretch to say he made that movie by any, by in any way, shape, or, do you mean like, all, or it's just like, it's funny, I get, you know, hundreds of LinkedIn requests, people trying to connect with me. And like, there's the ones that, you know, oh, this is just somebody who wants to sell me something, like, no thanks, right? Mm-hmm. And then you get those ones that are on the fence where you're like, oh, this might actually be somebody I would actually be interested in developing a relationship with. I'll like immediately click on our mutual connections. And I'm looking at those mutual connections.
Same.
And I'm like, that is a huge signal to me of like, I'm busy, right? Like, am I really going to spend the time to connect with some random stranger off the internet? Da, da, da. But like, depending who we know in common, that can be like, I'm like, wow, if you're connected to those people and you're not connected to a whole bunch of other people that negate that, right?
I'm like,
I'll take that. So I'm interested how you, Steve, how you think about it. I mean, Hampton's Tech Week, you're doing with all these cool people and sports stars and millionaires and all this stuff. There's a lot of people who want your time, that want free stuff from you, that want all these things. What's a quick way to not make it onto Steve's list? And then what are some of the people that did make you interested? Like, what's a common trait?
Again, it's always the people. Like, I can barely remember the last person that I've spoken to or connected with via cold outreach. I can't really recall ever in the last, like, I've never been that guy. So people have always been at the absolute core of everything that I do. And I really rely on everybody else's filter. Because even if I get introduced from like one angle, I'll clear it through somebody else after a conversation with them. Because I really don't like, it's funny, I probably should, but I don't research people on the first meeting that much. Like I'll kind of have a LinkedIn bio, but like I really want to hear from them how they view themselves and how they want to be presented and all of those other things. And then I'll research more after. But usually my filters will be the people on the front side of like, hey, had a great first conversation. This is my initial take on this person. How do you feel? Like, what have you done in the past with them? What are all the signals there? And kind of there's verification on that, but also, hey, is he a cool dude? Like, is he somebody we're going to go grab a beer with? Is she really what she said she is? And all of these things. And I think it, you know, having a really good inner circle has changed everything from that standpoint of like, it's very hard to get through. And time, if, as long as you give a long enough time frame, we'll always find the real people and they stay, right? So it's just the constant filter that you have as a friendship core, but also a business core. And those are even blurred now of like, it's just you do business with friends and we really kind of grow together, but we've also learned better filters together.
Yeah. Weston, I want to ask you the same question. You're involved in making movies and like making major things happen for nonprofits. You're connected to billionaires and you're like the friendliest guy ever. I promise that I know there's a whole bunch of people like trying to get you to come do stuff for them, or they want you to advise on this thing, or they want, you know, like I know that's happening to you all the time. What's a quick way to not get on Weston's list? And then what do you see in common amongst the people that you're like, oh, I'll take a risk on this. I'll see where this relationship goes.
Yeah, so kind of like Steve, I'll start with the second part. My filters nowadays is I only want to meet people through folks that I trust, because I know if, you know, they really enjoyed the conversation, they say they're a good person, then I'll talk to them. Because my BS meter is very low. Like, I don't pick up a lot of BS. Like, I'll believe everyone, what everyone says, which is like, I'm getting better at it now that I've been burned so many times. But I want to believe that the person's saying what they're saying is truth. And then go to the first part. what I really look for in someone is if they have one, an abundant mindset. So they're not limited by, you know, not having enough or scarcity, like the scarcity mindset. And then two, that they'll give first. So that's why I'm always big on, if I'm going to ask something from someone, especially if it's like on a Zoom or in-person coffee, like I make sure that I'm going to be the one that's paying for their coffee, or I'm going to be starting my follow-up email with like, these are the people I want to connect you to help you personally and professionally. And I feel like if more people had that mindset of being, a giver than a taker, that the world would be a lot better place. And I totally view both you guys are, I'm blessed to have you guys in my life, because I do feel like you guys are givers and try to make the world a better place. And that's what the rest of my life, that's all I want to do business with, is people that this are with that mindset.
I think this is so funny. This is a podcast episode, because I just feel like I'm like hanging out with friends. You know, like, it's funny. This is, I hope somebody else gets something out of this, because I had a lot of fun. I don't know if anybody else. I have a theory on that. Here's the theory. You know, after 950 podcast people, if you're having a good time and the guest is having a good time, the audience is probably having a good time. That's like my full philosophy on podcasts.
I love it.
Steve, if people want to find out more about Hampton Tech Week, maybe get tickets, all this kind of stuff, apply for it, what's the website? Where should they go?
Sure. Just hamptonstechweek.com. And also our Instagram is the same thing.
Okay. And for people who want to follow you, is LinkedIn the best place, Instagram, or where else?
LinkedIn's great. I definitely post very different things. You're going to have to deal with seeing pictures of my family and the dogs, if you follow me on Instagram. But LinkedIn is where I'll always share everything professionally.
Cool. Final question for me. There's so many people that wish they had your level of success, especially by your age. And most don't. Statistically, you're an anomaly. What do you think you've done that not everybody else has done?
You're definitely talking to Weston, because he's better than me here.
What do you think you've done different? What actions have you taken that not everybody else took?
I definitely think there's the risk factor again, similar to relegation, right? Like, you have the chance to just completely fall on your face and fail. And I have before. A number of times. I think there's a lot of people that just aren't comfortable doing that, and not doing it more than once either too. Like, if they fail once, it's embarrassing. It's hurtful. You lose a lot of faith in people when things happen to you. It's very easy to fall into a negative mindset from things happening to you like that. And one, to be able to get it back up and just do it again and stay positive and kind of start the next thing and trust your gut and doing all those things, I think is hard. And also just having the ability to take a risk that you definitely don't know if it's going to pan out. But if that's being a founder or jumping into a situation that you think is going to be fruitful, I think it's taking the shots are really what separates people, because I think a lot of people fall into the sheep conversation like we were having before. You know, it's very easy to it's not easy to get a job now. I've heard the job market's very hard. I've never like had a job. I've always kind of worked for myself in more of an entrepreneurial role or company. But I think that's the majority of people. If it works out, if it doesn't, I think you just got to keep putting shots up.
Yeah, solid advice. Weston, anything you want to leave us with today?
No, I would agree, man. I would say Steve is a very, very abundant-minded. He's a very positive person, and he surrounds himself with good people. So I think that's why he's gotten to where he's been, is you are the sum of the five people that are closest to you. And if you have good people around you and you take chances, like, you'll be successful in this world.
I love it, guys. Thanks for making time to do this.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, Jess.
Okay, bye, everyone.